Welcome to the Yeshiva Shalmaila. This is David Lichtenstein. This week we're going to be speaking about marijuana, what it means for us societally, and it's just a matter of time until it's legal in the entire United States. Like, does this mean, you know, in a few years you're going to go to a simcha and there's going to be a selection of scotch, bourbon, and marijuana? Is it going to become, you know, part of all the other things societally we do? Or is it going to still be taboo? Halachically, hashkafically? We're going to have an interesting group of guests. We have Rabbi Beryl Wind, a noted Rav, historian, a lecturer. He's going to speak about it from a historical point of view. We're going to have Rabbi Avram Neuberger. He wrote many articles about it. He's the Rav of Shari Tefillah, New Hempstead. He's going to speak about his personal experience with Bachurim who do use marijuana. From Baltimore, we're going to have Dr. Leslie Klein, the academic dean of Torah Seminary in Baltimore, a college in Baltimore. And she's going to talk about how she does not see any addiction issues by girls, drinking, smoking. She says it seems to be a problem that, at least maybe apocryphally, we hear from boys, not from girls. On the other hand, we're going to hear Rabbi Yisrael Grossberg, the Mashkiach Ruchni of Benos Chaya Academy in Brooklyn, that deals with girls who are struggling, who's going to talk about the girls that it does have an impact on, marijuana, girls who may be coming from more, you know, who are struggling backgrounds. We're going to have Rabbi Moshe Elephant, the COO of the OU, famous Tafyomi Magichir, and he's going to be speaking about any halachic issues. Is it kitnius on Pesach? Does it need a hechsher because there are additives to many different types of marijuana? And then we're going to have from a noted addiction expert, Thomas Gagliano. He's going to speak about the dangers of addiction and is marijuana, quote unquote, a gateway drug. So this is a topic that we don't have much about it. It's relatively, new issue. And Ramesha does have a tshuva on it. But for the most part, it's new grounds and interesting conversation. I do want to say that this week I'm going to do something unusual. After I say avart about Hanukkah, I'm going to ask 8 riddles. You could, if you're not interested in halacha riddles, you could skip over it. 1 for each night of Hanukkah. And whoever gets the best answers, whoever sends us in a compendium of answers, that is the best, because, you know, many of them have more than one answer, or you could disagree. We're going to give a $250 prize to. He can use it either for Svarim, Latkes, whatever you prefer to. We're going to do a lottery, and our noted in-house Goyen will mark it. He'll choose who the winner of the lottery is. But before we go to our guests and riddles, I would like to, you know, say a vart on Hanukkah. The Maral famously says that Hanukkah always falls out the longest night of the year, the longest, darkest, immediately preceding the winter solstice, after which it turns towards the light. Lailos haruchim shel kislev. And it's truly, it was a dark time. Giborim biyad chaloshim, rabim biyad ma'atim, tmeim biyad tahirim. You know, the mighty Greek Empire, 800 years of it, Hellenistic Greece that produced Aristotle, Plato, Alexander the Great. This mighty army, an 800-year-old fortress, Matisyo ben Yochanan Kohen Gadol Chashmonai Uvanav and his 5 sons took on and ultimately defeated. Talk about an act of sheer craziness. There's no way to go up against such odds without hope. Right? Hope. Mimamakim krasicha Hashem. And what does it say? Kivisi Hashem kivisa nafshi. I hoped to kaviyachal. Do you know that? I don't think there's another word. I shouldn't say that. Hebrew language is very big. But in Lashon Kodesh, so many words for hope. You have kivisi, kiva, tikva, yachel, kisuf, yahav. This week's parasha, Shamar, Sikuit, Tzipia, Sheifa, many words, synonyms for hope. It seems that hope is a message that is very big in Kfal Yisrael. And you know that you say, of course, we hope for the best. You know, Yachal Yisrael Hashem. But many cultures don't agree with that. You know, Nietzsche, the famous philosopher, German philosopher, he said, hope is the worst of all evils. Many quotes like that. Hope is an evil which has destroyed many a man. V'chulu v'chulu, many philosophers, they believe hope, you know, false hope. On the other hand, Klal Yisrael, it's in us to hope for a better tomorrow, a better world. And for us, you know, miyachalim al Hashem, hope is that holds up the world. You know, this is what allows us to face. But, you know, hoping has a dark side to it. When you hope, you're vulnerable, especially against odds. You could look foolish. You're hoping for something that is like a long shot, which is why so many psukim about hope. Ki ani Hashem asher lo yevoishu kovei. They won't be embarrassed. Hope, have that dream against odds. Lo kol kovecha lo yevoishu v'lo yikolmu lo netzach kol achosim bach. Don't be embarrassed to hope. Do you know that with all the synonyms there are for hope, there's not even one time in the entire Torah that the word yush in any form appears? It seems that hope goes to the essence of Klal Yisrael. Matasyahu Banav, you know, in this week's parsha, Yosef, right, and Yavan, Chazal are full of the connection. But look at Yosef. Look at a person who was really violated, maligned, and he never loses his demeanor, his positivity. I'll give you an example. It says Yosef, after being, you know, the ohov, the bechir of the sons, right? V'yev Yaakov is Yosef mikol banav. After that, he gets sold by his brothers. One of the greatest crimes in the whole Tanakh. Hashloisha pishe Yisrael val arba loya shivenu al michrom bekesef tzadik. Goes about Yosef. Arba v'loya shivenu, an unforgiven sin. It rates with the egel as the unforgiven sin. Then he goes down to the house of Potiphar. And what happens? He becomes framed by an adulteress or a would-be adulteress. And then he ends up in a dungeon. But look at his attitude. And I'm going to bring you a raya. It says in Miketz, Vayar oisam, he sees the saroifim and the saramashkim, vihine zoyafim, they're in a bad mood. I ask you, somebody who's been sold into slavery, when you talk about having a bad, being violated, then being framed, then ending up in a dungeon, circa 3000 BCE, right? Imagine what an Egyptian, make Rikers Island look like a hotel. Yet he's in a positive enough frame of mind. Instead of thinking about escape, revenge, suicide, he's in such a good frame. He says, I notice that your countenance today is not like it was yesterday, he tells the Saroifim and the Saramashkim. Like, you're so tuned in, you're so present, you're so aware of what other people are feeling. You could see their emotions, even though you've come through such trauma, post-traumatic stress disorder. And the answer is, Aviv Shomer Es Hadav, his father hoped, he waited. Yosef is surrounded by hope. Who else in the Torah do we see hope? Shimshin Hagibar, blinded, emasculated, hair cut off, in a Philistine jail. What does he say? Lishu Ascha Kivisi Hashem. He hoped before he topples down the palace and kills everybody. And even closer than that, Vayivaser Yaakov Levadai. Yavik Sarashi says, why did he go back? He went back for Pachim Ktanim. Strange Rashi, it's a Chazal. Pachim Ktanim, like he was a miserly. So the Marshal and the Tzedol Derech, they both say one thing. They say it was actually a Pach Shemen. You know, Yaakov promised, it would say, Vayikach Esu Evan, Vayasam Oysam Atzeva, Vayitzoik Shemen Al Rosha. He was going to anoint, if he returned safely, he would make a Matzeva La Shemen anointed. He said, that was the Pach Shemen. And he says, and that was a remez to the Pach Shemen of Hanukkah, both the Marshal, right, in the 15th century, and the Tzedol Derech say. Like, here's an interesting thought, the Pach Shemen. Yaakov is not unlike Matisyahu or Yosef. He's going back to face the scariest moment of his life. When he ran away from his parents, it was scary, but it was only him, right? Eliphaz captures him. Again, scary, only him. Here he is with his wives and his 11 children, the oldest of which is 13 years old. And he's coming towards Esav, Arba Meis Ishimai, 34 years later. Esav is enraged. He's angry. He's fuming. And Yaakov's about to meet him, and he goes back for the Pach HaShemen. And you know why? Because the candle of Hanukkah, in the darkest night of the year, according to the Maral, the longest nights, when you light a candle in such darkness, what are you saying? I hope. I believe. A tiny bit of light. Who knows what it could bring? It could bring a second candle, a third candle, a fourth candle, a fifth candle. It's the ultimate act of hope. The lights of Hanukkah in the longest night, against the odds of the Yavanim, the great Greek empire, that represents the kindling of hope. Kaveh l'shu'oscha kivisi Hashem. Kaveh el Hashem. You know why Yaakov Avinu goes back, perhaps according to the Marshal for the Parshemen of Hanukkah? He's about to face Esav, the scariest moment of his life. You know what he has to do? He has to light a candle. He has to kindle the hope. Kaveh el Hashem. But Chazek v'yamayz lebecha, time it gets really scary, and what does it say then? Kaveh el Hashem. You have to again hope to Hashem. Yaakov Avinu goes to rekindle the candle of hope, the candle of Hanukkah. This was a hard year for many of us. Many of us lost people. Today I was notified of a friend of mine's mother who died of COVID. We just lost two huge Talmid Hachamim, Rebelli Brudni, Shvaga to COVID. From a financial point of view, what did he say? A third of the businesses, of the small businesses in New York, are in danger of toppling. Social displacement, minyanim, tfilas, chaverim, people seeing their children, elderly seeing their grandchildren. It's been really the worst year in a decade, maybe since the Great Depression, which was well over 100 years ago, not well over, a little less than 100 years ago. And you know what Klal Yisrael's message to the world is? Klal Yisrael lights a candle in the darkest night. The message of Klal Yisrael is not like Nietzsche v'chaverov. We light a candle. We kindle hope. In this dark year, this Hanukkah has a special meaning to me. Tonight, I'm going to go out and light the message of Klal Yisrael to the Talmudoi Bishuk. Klal Yisrael, by the way, it's Machlekes HaPoiskim. Do we light for the Goyim too? Is that also Persumei Nisa? Rashi says, Achetech L'regom L'shuk Talmudoi. We will light L'farsem, both among Achenu B'nei Yisrael and the world. We hope. Klal Yisrael, L'shuascha, Kivisi Hashem. Let's go to our riddles of Hanukkah, with 8 Hanukkah riddles. Okay, here's the first riddle. The Gemara says, as the Shulchan Aruch and Tafrei Shayin Aleph Ches says, that if you have a chatzer that has a house that has two doors in the front and in the back, you have to light in both sides. Why? B'pnei achshad. People shouldn't think that, oh my, here's a Jewish house, and they didn't light candles. They passed by the back door. So you have to light on both sides. As Yosef says, b'zmaneinu, that we light inside, it's not negeya, but that's the Ikara did. Question is, the Shulchan Aruch and Hilchas Tefillah and Simon Tzadik, it paskins the exact opposite. It says that if there's a Beis HaMedrash, you can't pass the Beis HaMedrash b'shas HaTzfila without entering, because people will think you're an apikiris. This was in those days when there was usually one Beis HaMedrash in town. But it said, but if the Beis HaKnesses has a second door in the back, you're allowed to pass. Why? Because nobody's going to be chayshid you. They're going to say, he's not going in this door. Mestama will be down the kafschus. He's going in the back door. Right? That's in Simon Tzadik. I think it's Sivkat and Ches around there. So the question is, by Beis HaKnesses, as we say, if you have a second door, we're not chayshish you, we assume l'toiva, you're going in the other door. Here, when you have two doors, and by the other door there's nothing, what do we say? Oh my goodness, but you have to be chayshish the guy. He's not lighting there as Hanukkah. Chayre, it seems to be a stira in the psakim of the Shulchan Aruch. First riddle. Here's a second shayla. I heard it from my old yedid, Zechayin Levracha, Goyin Rebelli Baruch Finkel. The halacha is, if you don't have what to eat, shoyel ala psachim, and if you don't have even less than that, what's the halacha? Moicher ksusai. That for near Hanukkah, you have to sell your ksus. It's one of the most chomer, we'll speak about it a little later, of all the mitzvah. There's no other mitzvah except for, arguably, except for Dalad Kaisis and maybe one or two other cases, but moicher ksusai. So here's the question. It's Erev Shabbos al Hanukkah, and a guy doesn't have money, not for Shabbos, and not for near Hanukkah. But he has a jacket, and he could sell his jacket. And halacha is moicher ksusai. What's the halacha? Ner Shabbos and Ner Hanukkah. Ner Shabbos comes before Ner Hanukkah. Why? Because of Shalom Bayis. So therefore, for Shabbos, you don't have to sell your clothing. But for Hanukkah, you do have to sell your clothing. So what's going to happen? You're going to sell your clothing for Hanukkah. Now you have a dollar. Now that you have a dollar, what are you supposed to do with the dollar? You're supposed to light Ner Shabbos. Now, for Ner Shabbos, you don't have to be Moichek Susay. So now that you could take the dollar that you're going to buy Ner Shabbos from, and you take that dollar, and you're going to buy back your jacket. You buy back your jacket, You have to sell your jacket for Ner Hanukkah. You're going to sell it for Ner Hanukkah to use that money for Hanukkah. Shabbos is going to come along and say, no, use it for Shabbos. Aha, now I have the candle for Shabbos, but I don't have a jacket. I have a right to sell my candle to buy back my jacket for Shabbos. So you're going to end up going around and around and around in a circle. What do you do in this situation? This was Mishaila of my Yedid, Reb Eli Baruch Finkel. Here's a question for the third night of Hanukkah. The Taz in Siman Tov Reish Ayin Tes says that if a person is Makabel Shabbos, before he was Madlik Ner Hanukkah, he made a mistake. He went, he had an early minyan, he comes home, he says, oh my goodness, I didn't light Hanukkah. So what does he do? He has a shliach to be Madlik for him. So the question is, the Gemara says in Kiddushin and Achav Gimel, Kol Man De'iyu Loi Matzi Ovid, Shliach Loi Matzi Mashvei. Here it's the same thing. Since he was Madlik near Shabbos, he can't anymore make a shliach. He should not be allowed to anymore make a shliach, or wouldn't help. Not he's not allowed to. It wouldn't help anymore to make a shliach for Ner Hanukkah because it doesn't have the din shlichos would not be chal. If you can't call man to iu loy matzi ovid shliach loy matzi mashvei. This is our third riddle. By the way, that was the kasha of the Prima Gadim. Yes, Thunder Taz. Here's our fourth riddle. And that goes Rabbi Kivagin, Tafrei Shayin Aleph. He has the kasha now on the Prima Gadim. The Prima Gadim says that just like by Esrig, does Alacha al Yavaz viz Yosem Michay Mish Menachasav, that if a person wants to buy an Esrig, he doesn't have to spend more than a fifth of his money on the Esrig. He says it's the same halacha by Nir Chanukah. Frak Rabbi Kivagin, how could that be? The Alacha by an Ani, a destitute person, is he has to sell Ksusay Lenir Chanukah, even though Ksus, if that's all he has left, is the shirt on his back. But Pashtus, it's Ahoin Rav Yoisa Michay Mishneh Menachasav. So he argues on the Prima Gadim, and he says that Avadi have to be more than a Chaymish. But the question is, how did the Prima Gadim miss, the great Prima Gadim, miss a Beferishi Gemara and a Halacha in Shulchan Aruch that says, Yomoychik Susay, how could he possibly say, Hayuvazviz al Yuvazviz Yoisa Michay Mish? Goes on Hilchas Chanukah too. That is our fourth question. Our fifth question is sort of an easy one. The Gemara says, Ner ishu beisai. One person lights one candle for the whole house. The Mahadran lights, Machloikis Tais Ramam, one candle for every person in the house, or each person lights a candle. That's the Mahadran. The Mahadran, Mina Mahadran, is everybody lights their own candles, and everybody lights up to eight candles by themselves. So we have three levels. But Meikar Adin is Ner Ishu Beisai. And that's called Mahadran. Do you have to be a Mahadr? You don't have to be a Mahadr. Mahadran is Hidr Mitzvah goes until a Shlish. You don't have to be a Mahadr. So the question is, why does the Shulchan Aruch Mashmit, it doesn't mention the din of Ner Ishu Beisai? All it brings is the din of the Mahadran. Mina Mahadran, not only the Mahadran Mina Mahadran is the only one it brings. Pella on the Shulchan Aruch. This is, again, Akasha of the Prima Gadim. Here's another Shaila. The din always by Hidr Mitzvah is Ad Shlish. In other words, you want to buy an Esrig for $100, you can get an Esrig, spend up to $130. You don't have to do more. Frek de Welt, the whole din of Chanukah is Hidr. Hadrin, Mahadrin, Mina Mahadrin, Mahadrin, Mina Mahadrin. Right? So this is the din of Hidr Mitzvah. What's the din of Hidr Mitzvah? Ad Shlish, up to a third of the essential cost of the mitzvah, and not more. By the main din of Hidr Mitzvah, which is Chanukah, what do we say? Eight candles, Yil Yotze, with one candle. It's 800%. It's not a 30% Hidr. It's an 800% Hidr. How could the Ikadin of Mahadran of Chanukah be neged the din of Hidr Mitzvah Ad Shlish? That is our seventh Shaila. And our eighth Shaila is, the halach is always roiv am hadras melach. So like, you know, when we used to have guests on Shabbos pre-COVID, you know, sometimes you'd have somebody they wanted to make their own kiddush. It's very admirable. Halachically, it's incorrect. We say roiv am hadras melach. If one person makes kiddush for everybody, one chala, you make one lecha mishnah for everybody. That is roiv am hadras melach. Yet surprisingly, roiv am hadras melach, that is the hidr mitzvah, hadras melach. Surprisingly, by Chanukah, which is again a din of Hidr, Mahadran, Mahadran, Minam, Mahadran, what do we say? Not Bereivam, Hadras, Melech, and one person should do it for everybody, but everybody does it for themselves. This goes against the very essence of Bereivam, Hadras, Melech, the din of Hidr. Why is this hiddur different than all the other hiddurim of the whole Torah? Here is the last one, and it's really the struggle of the Bir Halacha. In Tof Reish Nun Vav, the Riyamaschal Afilu, the Oilas Tamid and the Elio Rabbah bring a raya from the Yerushalmi in Perak Aleph of Peya, that if somebody doesn't have tefillin, he doesn't have tzitzis, I mean, these are essential mitzvahs, he doesn't have a sukkah, he doesn't have a lulav, a shofar, I mean, really the big mitzvahs, there's no chiyuv to be machzer al hapsachim. You don't have to beg, you don't have to go door to door, look, I don't have it, oinis rachmana patra, I have no money for tefillin, tzitzis, sukkah, lulav, shofar, you don't blow shofar, I don't have the money, end of story. So he asks, I don't understand. Near Hanukkah and Arba Kaisis, you have to be shy al hapsachim, even though it's a drabanan. How is it possible that two mitzvahs drabanan of Arba Kaisis and Near Hanukkah are more chamer than all the mitzvahs in the Torah? All the mitzvahs are saying the Torah, you do not have to beg for any of them. You don't have the money, you pata. You don't have the money for a lulav, an esrei, okay, what could I do? But I didn't have parnasa. Baruch Shalom didn't send me parnasa. Lo yizachisi. Here, a drabanan more chomer than all the assays in the Torah, and surprisingly, the Mishnah Berurah in effect argues on Yerushalmi and he disagrees. But I mean, that's something for Mishnah Berurah to argue on Yerushalmi. But the ha'ara on the Yerushalmi and the Elio Rabbah and the Olam Tamid is an amazing ha'ara. Those are our riddles. Whoever gets the best group of answers, we will send a $250 to. We will of course play all the answers on the on our site. Let's go to our wonderful guests. Here is Rabbi Beryl Wine, the noted Rav, historian, lecturer. He's going to speak about the dissolution of society in America right now and how we should outlaw drinking too. He's concerned. He's a person who looks at the world through millennia and he thinks America is falling apart. Here's Rabbi Wine.
Rabbi Wine?
Yes?
Shalom Aleichem. My name is David Lichtenstein. I interviewed you and your son once for that Avay Subanim, you know, And your daughter too, three generations.
Yeah.
Yeah. They legalized marijuana in New Jersey for recreational use. And opinions are all over the place. Some believe that it's going to be like schnapps. You know, it gives people a high like schnapps. So like wine in many yeshivas, you know, Friday night, they do use schnapps and wine, sometimes to the consternation of the rabbeim, sometimes not. I chassid them, it's applauded, it's mashka, you know, within moderation. What's the Rav's opinion? Where do you see, like in 10 years from now, looking 10 years, 20 years, when you're going to go to the grocery and next to the Stella Dora cookies, there's going to be marijuana. What do you think the hashkaf of Klal Yisrael is going to be towards marijuana?
I think there'll be a lot of guys that are permanently high.
And what will the hashkafa be mitzad like the hanhalo?
What's the hashkafa? It's not good for you. Everyone knows it's not good for you.
But is it worse that, I mean, they say it's safer than alcohol from a medical point of view.
What? Safer, Shmaitis? It's all part of the dissolution of society. But we've been there before. It's the Romans. It's the Greeks. It's that's what it is, right? That's, you know, Chazal didn't smith it. Chazal didn't use it.
When you say it's similar to the Romans and the Greeks, what do you mean? What is the?
Well, they all drank to excess. They all used drugs. They were so homosexuals. All of that goes together. It's a piece of the puzzle.
So, Rabbi Wan, do you think we should be outlawing drinking?
I certainly think we should outlaw drinking. I've seen many a life ruined. Many have been totally ruined.
But by a simcha, we do have schnapps and wine.
Who has? Why do you have to have?
So would you give it more chaymer than scotch or the same?
I don't know. It's, I don't know, when I went to a wedding and I saw 18, 19-year-old guys, guzzling scotch one after another, that's not the Derech HaTorah, that's for sure.
And do you believe there should be scotch or bourbon by a chassan or by a l'chaim?
No.
Really? Never?
No.
Interesting.
I made weddings for my daughters and we didn't have to, no one had to drink.
But
they all got married and, lived happily ever after without the scotch.
And what about wine?
You can have a bottle of wine on on every table, but nobody's going to get drunk from a bottle of wine on the table.
I understand.
So the Rav's opinion is it's like all intoxicants that we don't really have a need for them.
We don't have a need for them, and they're harmful to us. If they're not harmful physically, because medical science says it isn't, but they certainly are harmful spiritually.
Yeah.
It's interesting.
There was a period of time when in the Sephardic world they would smoke the nargila that had hashish in it.
Right.
And there were gedolim that were ruined by it.
Like, give us a little history. This is right your expertise.
There's a tshuva from a famous Sephardic gadol that he said, he smokes before he davens, and then, niftachulom aruvas hashamayim, he sees heaven, he's stoned.
Right.
And you say this it's the Greeks. It's funny that this is Hanukkah time. You see a correlation.
Sure, it's the Greeks. The Greeks went to alcohol and drugs all the time.
And, well, it's interesting.
But this is part of the dissolution of America. America's fallen apart. So this is a piece of it.
And how? Where else do you see it? Like, what would you, if you had to build a picture here, what would it look like?
What, America?
Yeah.
You don't see it?
Look, I see a lot of change. To say I don't have the expertise to say it's falling apart, I don't look at
you
it.
You don't
see
that there'll come a time that won't be it won't be easy to be practicing Orthodox Jew in America.
For legal reasons or just
because? Yeah, for governmental reasons, legal reasons, social reasons.
In what way, Rabbi Wein?
Well, they'll tell you it's not healthy. They told you already you can't come and daven. You can't have more than 10 people. So they'll have another excuse.
Yeah. Well, the Supreme Court came down on
right. Okay, the Supreme Court, but he'll do it again, Cuomo. The people are with the votes are with Cuomo, not with the Supreme Court.
Right. So you see it as a further expression of the decay of society.
That's right. And the Jews are unfortunately part of it. They don't get it. They don't see what's happening.
When you talk about the Jews, you're talking about Jews like Schumer.
No, they're gone. I'm talking about our Jews.
And in what way are we contributing?
Because we have trained ourselves to live a life of excess, of luxury, of mosros, and that became normal. Guy makes a wedding in Dubai because he wants to have 500 people. Are they crazy?
Right. Yeah, well, hopefully, everyone, one good thing that may come out of this is weddings may become smaller, no?
God willing, the coronavirus will pass. After it passes, it's not going to get smaller.
Yeah.
Well, and you'll have more beggars than ever coming for Achmas's Kala because they got to have a fancy wedding.
Right. Rabbi, why could you share with us a thought on Hanukkah? What should Hanukkah mean to a Yid?
The Hanukkah is the nest of the little flame. The flame is ruchnius. There's nothing else there. It's all air. Nothing. That's what a Jew has to ascribe to, that there should be a single ruchnius in him or her. American Jewry is destroyed by Gashmius.
In a world running after material items, remember the flame. Remember Ner Hashem Nishmas Adam.
It's only the only thing that burns. The only thing that lasts is the flame. The flame doesn't need anything. It can last by itself. Everything else is dependent on something else. There's not enough oil. It burns anyway. Anyway, my friend, have a happy Hanukkah.
Thank you, Rabbi Wein.
Now, here is Rabbi Avram Neuberger, Rav of Shari Tfilah of New Hempstead, Magid Shir for Bochrim, deals with a lot of Bachrim that, you know, need assistance. And he's going to talk about his personal experience with Bachrim.
Welcome, Rav Avram.
Hello, how are you, Rav Avram?
So, Rav Avram, you did research about the use of marijuana, which has now been legalized for recreational use in New Jersey as well as many other states.
Right.
And it's just a matter of time, I guess, till it becomes nationally legalized. So my question is that are you going to come, Marshall, to a Purim Suda in various yeshivas around the world, and there's going to be wine on the table, there'll be schnapps on the table, and then there'll be reefers, joints on the table, so that if somebody wanted to, you know, if they allowed smoking, you know, indoors, some people, the house will now, or the shul, or the yeshiva will be smelled with the pungent aroma of marijuana. It's now legal, there's nothing wrong with it. And it's entered into the same pantheon as all other alcoholic beverages. What would you say, Rabbi Neuberger?
I would say that the fact that it's called a pantheon of alcoholic beverages and so forth, but it's a scary date that you're envisioning. You see, the first thing, well, you know, let me just give you a little background, okay? How did I come to this article? I came to this article because I was, like I wrote in the article, I was a Rebbe in a Beis Medrash, where it was a type of Beis Medrash that was for guys that had to, you know, need a little work. They were turned around. There's a lot of big Bate Medrashes like that in Eretz Yisrael, for sure. And in America also, you know, we guys need a little bit of space, and you work with them, and eventually they turned around. The modus operandi of these places was that we would give them space, and by Hanukkah, they would be bored of doing nothing, and they would, by self-motivation, turn themselves around, and it was a great system, and it worked in a lot of different places. You know, they had all the flip-outs, that type of, you know, language. It really worked. If you'll notice, in Eretz Yisrael, those yeshivas have really petered out to a large degree, and also in America, it's not working. And there were two factors that, and when I was a Rebbe, I saw it firsthand, that really killed the system. First of all, smartphones and so forth, the kids weren't faced with a sense of nothingness because they can constantly distract themselves, you know, with the next game and video and so forth. That was a major problem. But what was much more was the kids that had access to a pot. Their whole sense of motivation was completely undermined. It was awful to watch, and you couldn't talk to them. And so that, as opposed to a regular kid, after a certain point, you want to just get something done with your life, you know. It was like there was nobody home. They were just, you know, they were stoners, beamers up. Stoners, literally, like there was nobody to talk to. And a person has to have a sense of pain to grow. You know, that's, I saw a great part from he doesn't need my account. Well, I'm trying to write that if you want to get out of atzvos, you have to switch it to merirus. Because atzvos, depression, comes from the aside of misa, of death. Whereas merirus, bitterness, comes from the aside of fear, of being alive. So if you want to get out of depression, which is just like hopelessness, you have to say, I'm not putting up this anymore. I've had it with this, you know, and you have to take that internal pain and turn it into a motivation. And that is where the perniciousness of marijuana kicks in. It just kills motivation and has a very long lasting effect. So in the scene that you're envisioning, that I hope doesn't happen, it's a sad scene. It'll be just a world of a lack of accomplishment. And Rav David, if anybody has an appreciation of what motivation and accomplishing is, I think it's you. You know, it would be a very sad scene if that ever happens, the one that you're describing.
But how much were they smoking, these boys?
So that's the thing. It's a weird thing, you know. Everybody, and I addressed in the article, but I could tell you more about things that I didn't even write in the article, is that everybody, mixed kasha is, what's the difference between alcohol and marijuana? That's the question that you know, alcohol is mutter, and alcohol, the Torah, obviously, you know, advocates it in the right conditions. And marijuana, like I'm saying, what's the difference? So the difference that I spoke on in the article, but there's something else also, is that alcohol doesn't have such a long residual effect. You know, obviously, when I talk about a guy with stone, you know, a guy who's gone, you know, the Torah doesn't talk about that. But alcohol, once it's gone, you know, it's gone. But the residual effect
of alcohol is so much longer. I'm sorry, of marijuana stays in your bloodstream for I read somewhere 3 weeks, 2 weeks, and then that's only from one experience, you know. And therefore, the residual effect is like it overwhelms you. It's like I think because it's what I read somewhere it's a non-fat soluble which stays in your system for whatever reason chemically. It has this long-lasting effect of creating a blasé, non-motivated person. And I'm not the only one to tell you this. You can talk to anybody who's in the business who's seen kids that are stoners will note that. So that's on the first level, that's the major difference between alcohol and marijuana. And there's another difference. This I just found out recently from somebody who is now in the position of being mashpia on people. And he himself used when he was younger. And he told me, and this I've seen in other places also since, that alcohol is a connector. You know, when you know, like the famous image on Purim, you know, Rebbe, I want to be better when the kid gets drunk. But in any case, when somebody drinks, he connects to himself, he connects to other people, his social inhibitions fall away, and in a sense, it becomes more real. Whereas he says, it's like Bardic Manusa, the fellow tells me, he says, you can ask anybody who's been through the experience. It makes you alone. Even if at the time when you're high, you might be singing with some people and laughing at some stupid jokes or whatever it is, afterward, you look back at it, you became completely disconnected. You were not part of a group, you became disconnected, you were all alone. It's a very opposite type of experience. And again, so whereas alcohol in the right situations obviously is a good thing, you know, Hasidic Shetish, they promote it, and it creates like a certain vankeit, the Yiddishkeit that they feel is real and stays longer. The effect of marijuana is quite the opposite. It doesn't connect you, it disconnects you. It's a stoner. A stoner means to disconnect. I think the word, I looked it up, the word stoner comes from an early English term that meant like a stone hard rock that doesn't relate to anything, doesn't connect to anything. That's the whole idea.
I'm looking online. It says, smoking, it lasts 1 to 3 hours, though it can linger up to 8 hours.
Yeah.
Edibles can last 24 hours.
Well, I'm reading something from Rabbi Twersky, where he writes, and alcohol connects you to another person. The difference is that while alcohol stays in the body for 2 hours, the residual effect of marijuana stays in the brain for 3 weeks. Yeah. Additionally, there's a state of lethargy that commonly follows recreational use of drugs. Listen, Rav David, I imagine you never used it, and I haven't either, but I'm telling you, I saw it firsthand experience. I saw it.
No, but my question is, those, you know, there are people who drink, I drink wine on Shabbos. And there are people who, are, you know, they drink a few martinis every day.
Right.
So I think that, is it possible that with smoking, there's going to be a guy who maybe Erev Shabbos smokes, and there's a guy who smokes every day? Like, could that be the chilek that the boys you were just were overindulging?
Because it didn't seem that way at all, because they didn't have that much access to it. You know, the boys were from out of the country, and in Canada it was legal. So, or was almost legal. It was like they didn't care about it. So they would come back and they would still be like, you know, whatever. It had a residual effect. But again, I know it sounds like anecdotal evidence, but you could speak to people in the business, they'll tell you the truth. I want to tell you something. It's not just a problem with kids on the brink that my concern. I got a letter, an email from a mashkiach in one of the most well-known yeshivas in America, stating, and this is a senior mashkiach, is stating about that he's dealing with bachurim that learned in the most brand-name yeshivas in Eretz Yisrael, and it's commonplace, and it's a problem that is undermining the yeshivas. He sent me an email, thank you, Shkarek, for bringing it to my own attention. So you want to know if it could be done, in a moderate way, maybe, you know, but it's a dangerous game to play. That's something, because it has a very long residual effect. And I'm telling you what I saw firsthand. It's not just me. You could have other people to interview. You'll see. You'll get the same answer.
So if you had to guess, Rabbi Neuberger, let's think 5 years from now.
Fine.
Even though, you know, Yogi Berra famously said, predictions are very hard to make, especially about the future. Right? Wisest thing he ever said. 5 years from now, do you think you'll go to a simcha and there'll be, you know, schnapps, there'll be bourbon, there'll be wine, there'll be white wine, there'll be scotch, and there'll also be a selection of different types of marijuana. What do you think?
I hope not. The only way that it won't happen is if there'll be an education and a realization of what's going on. I think that it's pernicious. It's not like, you know, there's not going to be people dying on the streets from me. You know, it's like a different type of thing. I mean, it was a story recently in Muncie. I mean, it made it to Aloha, you know, that somebody had gummy beers or whatever they call it, with cookies in his car, and the kid was in the car and he thought it was regular cookies, and he ate them, and he almost died because he had, this was, I think at 9 years old, you can't ingest 3 cookies like that. And so there is a dangerous aspect to it as well. But I can only say that will it happen? I hope not. But it's the only way it won't happen if it would be education. You know, I read that a good line. There's a guy, Dr. Gabor Mate. He has a book about addiction called In the Realm of Hungry Ghosts. And he writes, it's impossible to get enough of something that almost works. You know, it's a great line. It's impossible to get something that almost works. The effect of pot is that it anesthetizes pain. Any pain, you don't have to deal with it. And pain is what allows us to grow. And if you're going to anesthetize that feeling, then, you know, you'll just keep on.
But remember, doesn't scotch do the same thing?
Yeah, it's true. So first of all, let's say it does, right? So scotch is also a problem. Yeah, I just spoke to somebody this week, had saw a guy who dealt with a bacha that had passed out, and if he wouldn't have been there on time, he would have died on his own regurgitation. You know, first of all, that's also a problem, and scotch is the problem, and there's no reason why we can't talk about overindulging in scotch as well. That's true, but I'm telling you again from personal experience, there's something about the fact that it kills motivation that I found to be so terrible about it. A kid has to feel pain to grow. Yeah, you can't anesthetize, and why would you want to deal with the pain if you can anesthetize it?
So what should the attitude of the chanchan be? Use in moderation, use very carefully, or it should just become taboo?
My feeling is it should be taboo. That you have to scare Brooklyn enough into feeling that it really could undermine everything that you're trying to do with yourself, and it should become taboo.
Well, Rabbi Neuberger, thank you very much for your thoughtful opinions.
Okay.
Cult of all the best. Take care. Bye-bye.
Now, here is Dr. Leslie Klein. She's the academic dean of the Woman Institute of Torah Seminary and College in Baltimore, who deals with, you know, just thousands of girls. And she's going to talk about how it's wonderful. She says, the girls we're bringing up today, for the most part, are really healthy and it's not an issue.
I've been mostly in the Siako system, which, Baruch Hashem, doesn't have a major issue with drug usage, and please God should continue to not have a major issue with drug usage. You know,
as well as alcohol, I imagine.
As well as alcohol. Yeah, 100%. You know, look, the Orthodox community is not immune to the ills of outside society. So is there are there instances of drug and alcohol usage in the from community in base access? Of course there are. But that's not like a major issue. It's not endemic. It's not rampant. It's not, you know, the paramount issue people are dealing with or schools are dealing with. It's, Baruch Hashem, it's really not a problem.
It's incidental, you're saying?
Yeah, it's incidental. It happens. Everyone knows it happens.
And your experience with boys, is it any different?
Apocryphally, I think it's worse. It's more of an issue than it is with girls. That's what I have heard. My experience is only with girls, but certainly I've heard it's more of an issue with boys. And probably with older, you know, by the time you're getting to 19, 20, 21, girls are getting married. They're not, wasting their time. They're motivated. They're moving. They're not getting into these kinds of negative behaviors.
Now, here's Rabbi Yisrael Grossberg, the Mashgiach Ruchni of Benos Chai Academy in Brooklyn, which is a school for girls who are basically on the street, the last stop. He's the founder of Al HaDerech for girls on the street and their families. And he's going to talking about how his girls struggle, and it's a gateway drug. So this is just a different opinion, but from somebody who's looking at society from a different lens.
Welcome, Rabbi Yisrael.
Thank you for having me.
Rabbi Yisrael, could you give us like a one-minute summary of what you do and what Benos Chaya and Al HaDerech do?
Sure. So Benos Chaya is a high school, a girls' high school in Brooklyn, although we have students from all around the world. This is really like a last stop for students who have been asked to leave their any school that they've been in. Some of them have coming literally straight from the street. And we give them an education and hopefully bring them back to Yiddishkeit as well and set them on their way. Al HaDerech is an organization that is, it says, one of the underserved groups are parents of kids going off the derech. There's such sorrow going on in these families, and so many are just don't know where to turn. So this is an organization that helps these parents, as well as working with the kids to help get them, you know, where they want to be.
So, Rabbi Yisrael, what's your opinion? Marijuana is now has been legalized in New Jersey. I imagine New York's going to follow shortly. Tell me, what's your opinion? You're a mechanech. You see, you know, drugs. You deal with girls. Give us some thoughts.
So, I mean, I have to be honest, I sometimes just sit here in shock. I just can't get over it because, you know, I see the karbanos. I see what's going on. And a lot of people, you know, the two words that really get me upset are, it's just weed. Okay, that's three words. It's just weed. It's not just weed. It's, number one, is weed itself has its issues in terms of what it does to a Talmud. I can tell you that, you know, Talmidim and the Talmidos that are regularly using weed, they're just not the same. They're not the same. It's very obvious. Their senses are dulled. Their ability to participate in any sort of class, conversation, etc., is highly impaired. And then there's the issue of the gateway, the fact that weed only works so far. Then they become addicted, not to weed. Everyone says weed is not addictive. That's true. But they become addicted to the high, and they'll do whatever it takes to get that high. So once weed stops giving them that high, they up it. And if I had a dollar for every kid who told me, I can stop whenever I want, weed is not addictive, who ended up with a serious addiction, I'd be a rich man. But they all say it, but unfortunately, it's just hard to stop. I just want to add also that, you know, what we're not realizing is that there's so many issues. Weed, maybe perhaps it will be regulated, I don't know, but right now there's a major issue of laced weed. People, Yiddish kinder from our Beis Yaakovs and our yeshivas and from all over who are buying weed thinking that they're just getting marijuana, and it is laced with much more serious things, in certain cases, very dangerous things. It's there's so much more to the question.
So, Rabbi Yisrael, let's go through these things. I imagine that if it's legalized, laced wouldn't become a problem, because laced is when you're buying it clandestine from Jose in a basement. And he can do whatever he wants. Once something is legalized, like when you buy a pack of Marlboro, it's not laced with anything. So I think that legalizing it would probably be a solution for this problem. It wouldn't create a new problem. Right? I want to go to your other point. Your point is the karbanos, okay? Like, the girls who are coming to you, and I don't speak pejoratively of them, because people, there's a lot of tsaras in life, right?
Mm-hmm.
I imagine they're coming from backgrounds where there's all kinds of abuse, right?
Not necessarily. I believe that that's a lot of people believe so. You know, they're coming from broken homes. It's really, there's so much that's going on. People don't realize when we talk about abuse that it's not only, you know, serious abuse. Sometimes there can be emotional abuse. From, you know, the best in the shensta, you know, from good families. But, you know, if you're anyone who's, like, you know, in touch with the scene of what's going on, the kids are coming from everywhere. They're really,
okay.
I think at this point we can't even say anymore that it's, you know, only issues.
Emotional abuse is as powerful as physical abuse, maybe more powerful. But my point is that when you say that karbanis and it's marijuana, doesn't it make sense to look at the thing holistically and say, her father screamed at her, or beat her, or there's a lot of, you know, tension at home. She's unloved, unwanted, and she's using marijuana. So isn't that a little bit like saying, like, suicide is creating so many problems? Well, it's not the suicide that's creating the problems. It's the abuse that led to the suicide. So is it the marijuana that's creating the carbonus, or is the marijuana a symptom of all the issues of unhealthy families, unhealthy parenting, even, you know, just very broken situations? And you're seeing the when people want to numb themselves, one of the things they do could be marijuana. So is the carbonus because of the marijuana, or is the marijuana, on the contrary, is the anesthetic that they're using because of the pain in their lives?
Right. So it's an excellent question, because I have to tell you, it pains me when I have to speak to, you know, the buffer or a girl who's dealing with this, and I'm telling them, it's almost like I'm telling them I want to do a root canal, but I'm taking away the anesthesia. Because that's what it is. Like you're correctly saying, this is what dulls the pain. So you're 100% correct in that, you know, what we really need to do is to get to the core of the issue, and that is to deal with these problems before someone has to turn to marijuana. That is, you know, it's a sad day when the only option is weed. The only option is marijuana, and this is what the kids say. And it's difficult. They can't imagine a world without it. They can't imagine a world where they can come home and be happy and be among their friends and be happy and be among, you know, whether it be in the sister or if they're on the street, wherever they are, without marijuana. They can't imagine that. And you're 100% correct in that, you know, it's foolish to think that if, whether it becomes legal or doesn't become legal, that we're somehow going to, that's going to solve our problems. You know, that's a cop-out. We really do need to get to the core of the problems as well.
So then is it fair to say that marijuana, from what you're describing, and I have no position on this. In fact, I'm old school. Like, for me, it was, you know, if you smoked marijuana, it was like, you know, Yerrig Valley. So, but marijuana is not the problem. Marijuana is they think it's a solution. It's an anesthetic. But like alcohol, like drugs, like more serious drugs, like all the other solutions, quote unquote, that people use, artificial solutions without fixing the problem, none of them are really a solution. So then is marijuana really a problem?
You know, so I once heard from Revolta, I was able to learn by, that you can never take away something from a kid, from a student, without giving them something else to take that place. In other words, if you're, as a punishment, or if you feel you don't want them to be participating in a certain event, you have to give them another event to participate in. So clearly, if marijuana becomes, you know, if we're realizing that it's unhealthy, if we're realizing that it creates a situation where a Talmud can't learn in yeshiva, where a girl can't, you know, go on with her life in a regular way, just saying no isn't the answer. What we have to do is come up with another option. We have to be offering options to, and, you know, by options, I don't mean other chemicals or other drugs. I mean, you know, real help so that they never get to this point.
So let me go back to my point. My point is, you can't tell me that marijuana creates new problems. You could just tell me that the girls who are using it as a numbing factor, it's not necessarily providing them a solution. It's just providing them a temporary cocoon where they could enter. But as for marijuana creating problems, you don't really seem to have an opinion on that. Is that fair to say?
So, yeah, I mean, it creates problems because of what it does. I mean, you can say the same thing about drinking. You know, there's
right.
plenty of people who drink, and they,
right.
you know, they're careful about it, and et cetera. But at the same time, we don't necessarily want everyone having access to alcohol, because not everyone's ready to deal with it, and not everyone can, you know, can function while taking it. So you've got to say that, you know, perhaps there are people, and I guess there's a whole other conversation in terms of adults, but, you know, who might be taking it in recreationally, and they're really not, you know, harming anyone, et cetera, and they're able to use it responsibly. And I'm not saying that it's impossible. I never tried it myself. I can't tell you for sure, but I just feel that the risks that we're taking by legalizing this and by somehow making it okay outweigh the few people that would like to be, or however many people would like to be using it recreationally or in a way that's not dangerous.
Okay. I mean, do you see alcohol as a problem too?
Absolutely. Yeah, and the truth is, you know, alcohol doesn't show up in a drug test. Or, I mean, there are some that it does, but, you know, we test. So we'll know if they're smoking. But alcohol is a quick fix that, you know, over a certain amount of time, much quicker than, is out of the system much quicker. So to a certain extent, alcohol in a way is more dangerous.
Have you found alcohol to be more addictive than marijuana?
So, you know, what it is, again, it's the numbing. So they're addicted to stopping the pain. You know, and I realize that some people might be listening to this and say, oh, come on, you know, they're just, it's a cop-out, they want to have a good time, they want to, but you have to sit and speak to these kids and see what's going on in their lives to understand that they just want out. So if out it means, you know, weed, then it's weed. If it means booze, then it's booze. You know, the hope is that, you know, through positive conversation and you know, actual help, that will be what, you know, what they're going to be interested in. But I don't see necessarily one more than the other.
Yeah.
Which actually surprises me, incidentally, that, you know, drinking will go on, yeshivas will go on in places that never in a million years would, you know, you'd have weed, but, you know, that's what happened because it's legal.
So I'm just curious, so let me ask you a question. Now, what is your opinion then for regular yeshiva boys or girls in healthy situations? Do you think they should have access to alcohol?
No. Again, I'm not one of these hardcore people that say they should even have alcohol by Kiddush because it leads to
wanting. So I'm asking you, so do you put schnapps on the table on Shabbos or when you make a Kiddush or something?
Yes, I believe that a parent can teach their child to do things responsibly, to keep an eye on things, and to be looking for you know, any danger signs, etc. But I don't think that it's something that should be completely, you know, taboo.
So then my question is, do you think marijuana should be like alcohol or no?
I just feel that because right now, in terms of what it does, in terms of long-range effects, right? A person drinks, they, you know, unfortunately they get inebriated, and, you know, over time, they have to deal with a headache, but they're pretty much back to themselves. Rarely do I see people that just smoke a little marijuana, or you don't end up going more. I don't see people from drinking by a Kiddush becoming alcoholics. Maybe I'm naive, but I don't see it.
Okay, so you're saying anecdotally you don't see the evidence and you believe it to be more addictive.
Correct. That's not scientific, just my, you know, what I'm seeing.
Anecdotally.
Right.
I mean, the other side of the argument, Rabbi Stroll, is that if marijuana becomes very common, right, which it sounds bizarre to us, but, you know, many things change so quickly. In a few years, it may not be. So is it better that the kids get a chinuch at home on something like that, just like alcohol? Or is it better that they get it on the street? Because if it becomes, like, ubiquitous, they are going to eventually bump into it.
Right. I mean, this is the old, you know, mein Gnuzen question, whether, you know, if we're, by creating this kind of mystique, that, you know, it just creates more of an interest and more of a want, as opposed to just, okay, yeah, it's there, it's available, it doesn't have that, you know, that same kind of feel of going and doing something that's, you know, usher or something that's, you know, behind their parents' back. It's hard to say, but what I just feel that the risk, you know, I could see why that maybe could work. I just worried about the risk of, you know, what can happen.
Right.
You know, it's not, I'm not saying that it's a sure thing that it won't work, but it's a, you know, it's a risk.
Yeah. Well, Rabbi Stroll, thank you very much for your time.
Sure, my pleasure. Have fun.
Also, bye-bye.
Here's Rabbi Moshe Elefant, the COO of the OU, the famous Daf Yomi Magid Share, I believe it's the largest in the world, the halachas of marijuana.
Welcome, Rav Elefant.
Shalom Aleichem, Rabbi Lichtenstein. Nice to speak to you again.
So, Rav Elefant, the OU has recently given a hechsher on marijuana edibles, brownies, candies, that are manufactured in California and are sold in, you know, 30 states. I think it's legal as for recreational in 10 states and medicinal in 30 states. And curious, did you have any moral qualms before doing it?
We had many, many, many hours of discussion and consultation before we gave Hashgacha to the marijuana product. Actually, I'd like to qualify that the marijuana product that we certify is only a medical product. We don't certify. The company that we certify does also produce recreational product, marijuana product, but we will not certify a recreational marijuana product. Not necessarily because of a kashrus issue, and it certainly probably could be certified as kosher, but as a matter of principle, the OU has avoided certifying cigarettes, for example. We've never certified cigarettes, even though I understand, I've never really personally investigated because we never gave the Hashgacha, there could be up to 200 ingredients in a cigarette, and we don't know what they are, but we've never and we've gotten many requests for certification of cigarette, but you know, every pack of cigarettes has the Surgeon General's warning how dangerous it could be, so we won't certify it. And similarly, we will not certify marijuana. We've actually been in consultation with the Department of Health and the Department of Justice, because even though there are states that have legalized marijuana, and many states have even legalized it for recreational purpose, it's the Department of Health in the United States still considers it a dangerous substance. And because of that, we will not certify it for recreational purposes, but for health purposes, we have. In answer to your question, it was many hours and a lot of consultation internally and externally, what is the right thing to do.
Rabbi Elephant, if it's just medicinal, what is the debate?
What is the debate?
Yeah.
So you'd be surprised at how many people felt that if by us certifying it for medical purposes, we're sort of putting a seal of approval around marijuana, and then people will be able to say, well, then it's okay under all circumstances. I happen to think that it's incorrect, and I'll tell you, I was in a different radio program a number of months ago, and somebody questioned me the same question, not necessarily a Talmid Chacham like you, but somebody questioned me about the OU certifying marijuana, and the individual said to me, well, you're taking the responsibility that because you're certifying medical marijuana, people, teenagers are going to start taking and smoking or using marijuana. I said, I have to respectfully tell you, I did not know the individual I was speaking to, that I don't believe that the person who wants to experiment with marijuana is waiting for the OU's Hechsher. That the person who wants to do it or doesn't want to do it, and I certainly don't necessarily recommend anyone should do it, is not dependent on that. But when people want to debate the subject, as you well know, there's going to be that kind of pushback. And that's why we took that pushback seriously. But what convinced us to do it is that so many people who we personally spoke to, who never suffer from different chronic pains and from different ailments that have told us how marijuana has helped their lives, was what pushed us to do it.
Uh-huh. Now, I've been asked, do you believe there's any shail of kidneys with marijuana?
No. We actually even discussed it with Rabelski Zatzal. Not that he was alive when we certified, there's no kidneys in marijuana.
And why is that?
Because it's a leaf.
But it also has seeds, the plant.
Everything has seeds. An apple also has seeds.
Well, that's true. Here,
what doesn't have, if you're going to say that the seed is the proba of kidneys, then you're going to be very hungry on Pesach.
Well, it's true an apple has seeds, but I'm saying it grows, the hemp seed grows very similar to what would be like a grass seed or a wheat seed. So it does look like kidneys vis-a-vis an apple grows in a fruit. It's you know, this is very similar to wheat, or it would be very similar.
Okay, so we you could perhaps make that argument, and I don't know if that's the subject of today's show, but one of the issues that we had where the question came up was quinoa for Pesach.
Right, 100%. Yeah.
So I think marijuana is probably even less similar than quinoa, and we spent a long time debating that issue. In fact, originally we avoided certifying quinoa for Pesach, but after much deliberation, and if you really look in the Pesachim, I very often quote a tshuva. It's a short tshuva, but a fantastic tshuva from the Kol Zman Rebbe in the Shalos Tshuvos Divrei Yatziv, where he was asked many years ago about cottonseed oil, cottonseed for Pesach.
Right, and Reb Moshe has a tshuva about it, a very hotly disputed topic.
Right, and if you look at the Kol Zman Rebbe's tshuva, and the Kol Zman Rebbe was not known to be a makel in any sense of the word. And I've looked at that tshuva many times in my career. And what the Kol Zman Rebbe says there is that the kidneys is a minik. And because Kitnius is a minig, we follow the minig. We don't dispute the minig, even if we do or don't understand it. But it's not something that we're supposed to expand on. And what was part of the minig is included, and what isn't, isn't. There was no cottonseed oil in the time when this minig was formed, and therefore it should not be included. We all know the famous debate over potatoes, the Chai Adam and the Divrei Chaim. The Chai Adam would have had us not eat potatoes or potato starch over Pesach, and truthfully, not that he needs my haskama, his argument is very strong, because anybody who looks at potato starch could easily confuse potato starch with flour, right? But everybody uses potato starch.
Yeah, and I mean, yeah.
So if you could eat potato starch and you could eat cottonseed oil, you could certainly have kidney. Not that we're certifying marijuana for Pesach, but it's certainly certified.
So do you certify quinoa?
Yes, we do.
You do. Okay. Because I'm saying this, yesh for yesh.
And originally we did not. It took us a lot of years of deliberation, and then we decided finally to do it.
Rabbi Elephant, it's as always an honor and an education having you on.
Thank you. The feeling is mutual, and you should be able to help us do the Avodas HaKodesh of educating the Tzibur.
We're going to do that.
Okay.
Thank you so much, Kol Tov. Take care. Bye-bye.
Good night.
Bye.
And here is Tom Gagliano, a noted addiction author, best-selling author, a lecturer, and he's going to speak about the hole in the heart, addiction, marijuana, and the healthy way to deal with it.
Welcome, Tom.
Thank you, Dave. Thanks for having me.
So as an addiction expert, can marijuana be used safely? Like, you know, everybody, if you go to most people's homes, they'll have a wine cabinet or a liquor cabinet, and they could take out they could make a l'chaim after the herring or
right.
One time at night, take a little, you know, some schnapps in a glass. And can you buy some marijuana? And can you say, okay, let me smoke some marijuana? And it's the equivalent of having a glass of your favorite single malt whiskey. Not too much of it, half of a thing. Can it be used that way?
Sure it can. Here's the question. Is alcohol is legal? People have been drinking for years. Now, some people drink too much. They can't handle alcohol. It's an addiction. It's used to medicate their pain, take away their difficulties, regulate their discomfort. You know, when we use anything to overabundance, whether it's alcohol or marijuana, we have to look at that. And usually that occurs when we're doing something that's hurting our family. We're using it too much to hurt our family. We're not spending enough time with our family. We're not present. Or maybe we're getting in legal trouble, DWIs, or maybe if I drive high on pot. Or maybe I can't hold down my job because I'm partying too much. So, you know, when we start to cross those lines, that's when we have to look at it as being addictive. It's not wrong with drinking a little. But there is something wrong with drinking a lot. There would be nothing wrong with smoking a little marijuana, but there would be something wrong with smoking a lot of marijuana. So it really depends on the individual.
Now, is there any brain damage from marijuana? Is there any permanent impairment? Like, how dangerous is marijuana?
I think there is. I think, again, we go right to talking about alcohol. You know, alcohol, after years of consumption, will start to hurt your brain cells, will start to deaden your brain cells. I think marijuana will do the same thing. And again, marijuana could also be used as a gateway to bigger and more destructive drugs like heroin, whatever. Again, if you're an addict, what happens, addiction is progressive. You need more of whatever's happening as time goes on. And there are many people that are in jail that have destroyed their lives with heroin, with other areas that started with marijuana. And when they started, I know they didn't say, oh, gee, I'm going to ruin my life by smoking some marijuana. But inevitably, it can lead to be a gateway to more harmful drugs.
But Tom, couldn't the argument be made that so could alcohol be used as a gateway to other drugs?
100%. Look, anything. We have to remember always that when we talk about alcohol, marijuana, pornography, overspending, gambling, drinking, drugs, these are symptoms, Dave. They're really not the root problem. And, you know, as I speak about, the root problem is what's underneath it. It's the person growing up did not learn to develop healthy coping mechanism, regulating their discomfort, and they needed something to medicate that pain. They either act in with depression, isolation, or they act out with addiction. So when we talk about all of these different situations, these are the symptoms, really. That's not really what the issue is. And my methodology and what I use with clients is, it all really, the rudiments come from childhood messaging. You know, it's if I grow up with self-esteem, like I matter, like I count, it's less likelihood I'll overuse anything, marijuana, alcohol, or anything.
So can I go off on a rabbit hole for a minute?
Sure.
Okay. Do you think it's a healthy exercise for a person to have to make a list, maybe weekly, depending on what his self-esteem level is on that day, maybe daily, to sit down and write down 20 things about myself? I'm a good father. I'm a good husband. I'm a kind, I'm an empathetic person. Like, is it helpful for a person to have sort of a bag with all their attributes in it that they're aware of, that they write down, that they speak to themselves repeatedly to help their own self-confidence or to build, become your own father and your own mother from a self-esteem, through the prism of self-esteem? Or is it, would be an exercise in futility?
No, it's not an exercise of futility. It will help. I love affirmations. And in fact, I tell my clients to do the affirmations looking at themselves in the mirror. It's a little more powerful when you're actually looking at yourself. So affirmations will help. But you know, this is an inside job, not an outside job. That's why there's many very rich billionaires out there or celebrities out there or other people out there that conceivably have everything you could want in life, and many people have a lot of gratitude for the things that they do, the thing, but they still could be broken inside. See, because there's a long distance between emotions and intellect. Intellectually, we could tell ourselves these things, but the emotions are an inside job, and our emotions, our core beliefs are formed at a very young age. They're not formed in our 20s, 30s, or 40s. So those key times in our life, when we're young and we develop that sense of self that we need to be able to feel good about ourselves, because the most important relationship we have is not the one with our kids, with our family, with the community. It's the one we have with ourselves. I have to like me. And when I like me, that's a different deal than if I'm trying to get those accolades from the outside world.
And how do we do that?
Well, first, many times, we have to go back. We have to look under those unswept corners of our life. I've always said this, and I said this on your show before. Children are egocentric. At a very young age, before their mind develops, before their brain chemistry is all developed, they only know what affects them. Like I said to you, Dave, when my father was out drinking, I never said, oh, she's an alcoholic. I said, something's wrong with me. Now, anything you put ahead of that child, anything, whether it's religion, whether it's another sibling, anything, the child will eventually rebel against. That's what happens. Children got to feel that they're the most important thing to their parents. And what happens if they don't get that feeling, they could a lack of self-worth is created inside of them. And this is at a very early age. And that's when they grow up. Many people, many of my clients, are very well-to-do clients. And they thought that money was going to solve that problem. If I made enough money, it would fix and heal what was broken inside. That's not how it works. You have to first go back and challenge the childhood messages, challenge to see what messages helped you in your life, and parents give you a lot of positive messages, and what messages have you recognized that haven't helped you in your life. Maybe I got to be a perfectionist. I have to do everything perfect. Well, the definition of perfectionism is failure, because you can't do everything perfect. So if you're always looking at what you could have done better and not celebrating what you did right, it leads it to a very lonely, isolating life.
What do you tell your patients as a practice to say, build up that sense of self, your self-esteem? You said go back and try to do an editing on the things, the memories in your past were for childhood, which were negative, and I guess try to edit them out or do something to them. Maybe help us what? And on the positive ones, try to accentuate them. Is that a fair synopsis of what you said?
Yeah, I think we first, there's three pieces to healing our insides. It's self-awareness first. I have to know what's broken inside. Like I said, I can't be working on my foot if it's my shoulder that's bothering me. So I have to write down some of the messages I received in childhood. What were those from my caregivers? Did they give me that unconditional love? Did they tell me, hey, it's okay. You don't have to get an A on every test. It's okay. We all slip and stumble sometimes. I care more. Did we get that, or were we raised at a bar that we had to achieve in order to feel like we will love. So first we go over those messages and we build self-awareness. When we have self-awareness, then it becomes more Dave of a we process. Now I bring other group members into the growth with the client. Now they see how other people have learned to accept themselves more, like themselves more. We have groups. We talk about, you know, the things in life that trigger our discomfort. We talk about when we're discomforted. What can we do positive? If my wife upsets me, do I shut down? Do I run away like I always used to? Or now do I say, hey, you know, hon, when you said that, it was very hurtful. I'm not saying you meant to hurt me, but I want to tell you it was hurtful, and I'm telling you this because I want to get closer to you. So we start to change our actions in life. And then finally, the third piece is maintenance. If we consistently do these things, we start to build self-esteem. We start to heal. So in a nutshell, there's three pieces: self-awareness, action, and maintenance. Without awareness, I don't know what actions to take, and without actions, I'm really not going to maintain anything. So those are the three pieces that will help somebody start to like themselves better, start to feel better about themselves, and in doing so, it permeates into those closest to us.
Okay, now let's go back to marijuana. So if marijuana is like alcohol that could be used safely and unsafely,
mm-hmm.
Is there any reason not to use it in moderation?
It's a tricky thing. The question has a lot of other questions involved. I personally would have to know the client very well to know that. Do they have addictive tendencies? If somebody has addictive tendencies, I would tell them don't go near marijuana because you're going to become addicted to it. Why? Because it gives you feel good.
Worse than alcohol?
Worse than alcohol. I wouldn't put it on a scale better or worse. I just put it like right with alcohol. And
so,
again,
but then it's fair to say that most houses you would go to.
Mm-hmm.
I haven't been to one that isn't. Have a bottle of wine or a bottle mm-hmm. of whiskey, et cetera,
mm-hmm.
which means people feel confident, yeah, I'm going to have some wine and I'm going to have some, you know, whiskey and I'm not going to become an addict, right?
Mm-hmm.
So can those same people, and it's a new area of enlightenment. Most of us have never seen it. Now dispensaries, certainly in the States, the 30 state, mm-hmm. you know, the 10 states, say, listen, honey, when you're going to this store, you're buying a bottle of... I don't know, Smirnoffs, whatever you want to drink.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not a big drinker, so I'm a little bit ignorant.
Right.
Could you also stop by the dispensary and pick off? I saw Smirnoff just came out with a few cannabis products. Would you say it's the same thing or not?
The same thing, and has to be watched the same way. Now, again, think about this. Anything that gives you a feel-good, anything that gives you a dopamine hit, where the brain cells, the dopamine, gives you that really good feeling inside, like alcohol does, like marijuana does, like drugs do. Anything that gives you that dopamine hit, that feel-good inside, you have to watch that it doesn't get abused or overused. So, you know, again, if anybody came to me with any kind of addictive tendencies, I would tell them that if they started to do that, they're going to get addicted. Now, here's the real problem with addicts. Listen carefully. Every addict out there that starts their addiction thinks they're in control of their addiction. Everybody out there that's going to start to smoke pot is going to think they're in control of the pot. Some will control it. Some won't control it. Some will get to the point where the marijuana controls them. It becomes the most important thing in their life, not just a feel good, but something that provides them with a sense of oxygen. And this is the real issue with all addicts. All addicts believe that they're in control of their addiction until they hit some kind of tough bottom. Then they get honest, sick and tired of being sick and tired, in other words. So that is the biggest detriment in anything with addiction, is the person always thinks they're in control. And believe me, the cemetery's filled with addicts that thought they were in control of their addiction.
Okay, Tom. So to summarize, basically, alcohol and marijuana are both addictive. Right. And
mm-hmm.
if you have an addictive personality or you haven't learned how to control other pain in your life and therefore you
That's right. regulate your discomfort, correct.
Yeah, you haven't right so then you could be you're particularly vulnerable to the possibility of addiction.
Well,
and I would use both alcohol and marijuana very carefully. But otherwise there is no distinction in their both addictive behavior or it's hard to and neither in moderation create permanent damage. Is that a fair synopsis or no?
Yeah, I would say in moderation. I think you hit it on the head. That's the key word, moderation. And sometimes the person can't assess what's moderate to them. And I think that's the problem right there. Moderation's fine, but sometimes, you know, a lot of alcoholics out there thinks they're drinking in moderation, and they get their third DWI, if you follow me. So it's knowing what moderation is and being accountable, I think, Dave, to other family members and other people you trust, that they can give you feedback if you're smoking marijuana more than you should and if it's affecting their lives or your lives more than you may know. So I think it's a very good point here is to remember to get feedback from the people you trust, the people you love, and let them also answer if they feel like you're doing it in moderation. Because sometimes in life, we need that feedback from other people.
Well, Tom, thank you very much for your time.
Thanks. It's a pleasure.
All the best. Bye-bye.
Bye.
A Freilich Hanukkah to everybody. Wishing you and your family. It should be a zman of lishuascha kivisi Hashem, a zman of oyer, a zman to bring the menorah of the Beis HaMikdash, like the Ramban writes in Baloischa, into our own house. We should fill our house with light, with simcha, with the oyer of Yeshua. A freilich Hanukkah to everybody.